Hello and welcome. The other week I received a letter from someone I know who lives in Northern California. He wrote to me about an argument he had on Easter Sunday, April 24th, with members of his family about history, Hitler, and Austria and the Nazis. I'm going to read his letter and expand on some of the questions that he raises in this letter and some of the issues that are brought up by what he writes. Here's this letter from someone I know in Northern California. He writes, "Last night I had a terrible argument with my father about the Third Reich and Hitler. He has never read a book on the subject, nor has he heard a single lecture on these topics. His information comes from the movies and the History Channel. He could not combat my reasoning or facts, so he resorted to being angry and yelling in my face. I was calm the entire time, but I left angry and disturbed at how ignorant my father was and how he was unable to even listen to what I had to say. I then left to go to my girlfriend's house for Easter dinner with her and her family. Before we sat down to eat, the television was on and a movie was being shown, The Sound of Music. I commented that the father in the story, the naval officer, was an idiot for turning down the offer to accept a high-paying and prestigious post with the German Navy, and instead left the country with his family. I asked out loud why he was against the National Socialists. The others who were there spoke to me as if I had never opened a history book, and explained to me that you didn't have a choice under the Nazis, and that there was no way to get out of that job. As you might expect, everyone in the room spoke in the same way about the evil Nazis. By the end of the night, I had had it. I was so angry and stressed at people's lack of knowledge. Back at my house, I sat down with my girlfriend and played the DVD of your talk titled Hitler's Place in History. I bought it a year ago, but had not gotten around to watching it. In the first 20 minutes, you brought up the problems of people like my father, and you destroyed the Sound of Music myths about Austria, Hitler, and the National Socialists. What you said showed me and my girlfriend that I had been correct and justified. You saved my night from being ruined. So, Mark, thank you so much for your knowledge. Your fight for the truth is priceless." Well, I was moved and gratified by this letter, and I thought it's worth expanding on some of the points that he raises in this letter, and I decided to make it a subject for this broadcast. Well, The Sound of Music, as you probably know, is an entertaining and popular enduring American musical film. It came out in 1965 and stars Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer. It includes catchy and familiar tunes such as Edelweiss, My Favorite Things, and Do Re Mi. The Sound of Music won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. It's probably the most popular American musical film ever produced, and it's also one of the most profitable. In terms of box office income, it's the 3rd most financially successful movie ever, just behind Gone with the Wind and Star Wars. But as entertaining as The Sound of Music may be, it's dreadful, deceitful history. Its portrayal of Austria in 1938 is a propaganda distortion of reality. The movie portrays what it calls the Nazis as either sinister or misguided. It portrays normal Austrians as patriots and good Catholics who reject Hitler and the supposedly grim German takeover of their country. This portrayal is more or less the familiar and accepted one in America. Consistent with it, for example, the best-selling book The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William L. Shirer calls the 1938 Union or Anschluss, quote, "the rape of Austria." Well, what's the reality? How accurate is The Sound of Music? How did Austrians regard Hitler and the union of their homeland with the German Reich? Well, first, taking a look at the movie. It's true that the head of the family, Georg Ludwig von Trapp, who is played by Christopher Plummer, was hostile to Hitler and National Socialism. But he was not much of an Austrian patriot. In fact, he had been born in a town in what is now Croatia, but after World War I became part of Italy. Georg von Trapp and his children were citizens of Italy, not Austria. In the movie, he supposedly decides to flee the country with his family to avoid having to serve in the German Navy. It's true that he had been offered a commission as an officer in the German Navy, but he asked for an exemption on account of his age. He was 58 years old, and this was granted. So, in fact, he was not forced to serve in the German armed forces. In the movie, the von Trapp family leaves Austria in secret, and they are shown hiking over the mountains into Switzerland, carrying their suitcases and musical instruments. In reality, they left the country by train, and they did so quite openly. And instead of going to Switzerland, they traveled by train to fascist Italy. As daughter Maria said years later in an interview, quote, "We did tell people that we were going to America to sing, and we did not climb over mountains with all our heavy suitcases and instruments. We left by train, pretending nothing," unquote. But even more distorted is the movie's portrayal of Austria in 1938 and of National Socialism. In fact, the vast majority of Austrians welcomed the union of their homeland with the National Socialist German Reich and strongly, even enthusiastically, supported the Hitler government. A good book on all this, which I recommend, is a detailed study entitled Hitler's Austria. It's written by Evan Burr Bucke, a professor of history at the University of Arkansas. The book is published by the University of North Carolina Press, a prominent academic publisher. In the years before the Union or Anschluss, Austria was ruled by the Dollfuss-Schuschnigg regime, a repressive one-party dictatorship that called itself a Christian corporative state. It was a regime that oppressed and imprisoned dissidents, including National Socialists, as well as Marxists. On the eve of the Anschluss in March 1938, Austria's economy was in a catastrophic condition, and one-third of Austrians were unemployed. But people also knew that just across the border in the German Reich, economic, social, and cultural life was flourishing. Under Hitler, unemployment in Germany had been eliminated, and living standards and working conditions had greatly improved. There was one section of Austria's population that supported the dictatorial regime. That was the Jewish community, which made up 2.8% of the total. As Professor Bucke writes in Hitler's Austria, quote, "The Jewish community regarded the Dollfuss-Schuschnigg regime as its protector." He goes on, quote, "Under the Dollfuss-Schuschnigg regime, the Jewish community recovered a measure of governmental protection it had enjoyed since the days of the Habsburgs. The public was outraged." Although, as mentioned, Jews made up only about 3% of Austria's population, as Professor Bucke writes, and I quote, "The predominant position of the Jews in an impoverished country only intensified the fear and loathing of the Austrian masses. As we have already seen, Jewish businesses and financial institutions managed much of the country's economic life. At the time of the Anschluss, three-quarters of Vienna's newspapers, banks, and textile firms were in Jewish hands. The extraordinary success of the Jews in the learned professions also inspired jealousy and spite. Over 50% of Austria's attorneys, physicians, and dentists were Jewish." Even Hitler, who was himself a native of Austria, did not realize just how eagerly Austrians supported him and were looking forward to the union of their homeland with the German Reich. commenting on his entry into Austria in March 1938, Professor Bouquet writes, quote, "What he, Hitler, did not take into account was the tumultuous welcome he would receive from the Austrian people. An outburst of frenzied acclamation seldom seen since the days of the Caesars. The only people in Austria, in fact, who did not join in the outpouring of joy was a small minority of Jews, Marxists, and monarchists. Hitler ordered a free and secret national referendum or plebiscite on this great issue. As Professor Bouquet writes, quote, Hitler sincerely believed that all state power must emanate from the people and be confirmed in free state elections, unquote. In the run-up to the referendum, Austria's Roman Catholic and Protestant leadership, along with the country's labor leaders, issued statements welcoming the incorporation of their country into Hitler's Germany. The Catholic primate of Austria, Theodore Cardinal Innitzer, personally welcomed Hitler to Vienna. Together with Austria's other bishops, Cardinal Innitzer issued a pastoral letter urging all Catholics to vote for Hitler. The Catholic leaders also authorized the draping of swastika banners from the country's churches. In Austria, as well as in the rest of the German Reich, support for the Anschluss, as reflected in the referendum, was nearly unanimous. Even foreign observers acknowledged that this lopsided result authentically reflected the popular sentiment. Following Austria's incorporation into the German Reich, conditions improved quickly and dramatically. As Professor Bouquet writes in Hitler's Austria, quote, "In one of the most remarkable economic achievements in modern history, the National Socialists reduced the number of unemployed in Austria from 401,000 in January 1938 to 99,865 in September. In Vienna, from 183,271 to 74,162. By Christmas 1938, that is, in just 10 months, 27% more jobs existed in Austria than before the Anschluss. The unemployment rate fell from 21.7% in 1937 to 12.9% in 1938, and by 1940, it had fallen to just 1.2%. Between June and December 1938, that is, in just 7 months, the weekly income of industrial workers rose 9%. All in all, writes Professor Bouquet, the Austrian GNP rose 12.8% in 1938 and 13.3% in 1939. Seldom in history has a country experienced such rapid, dramatic economic growth. Germany's national labor law was quickly extended to Austria, which guaranteed basic rights at the workplace and afforded protection from arbitrary dismissal. Germany's comprehensive social security system also went into effect in Austria. This quickly provided relief to more than 200,000 desperately poor people and extended health care benefits to the working class. Along with this was wide-scale construction of new housing and a great expansion of cultural life with zealous promotion of music, the fine arts, and literature. Together with the increase in prosperity and optimism was a jump in the birth rate. Austria became part of the German Reich in March 1938. War broke out 19 months later in September 1939. The war, of course, brought many problems and hardships, but in spite of a shortage of labor, the economy continued to expand. In 1941, the GNP in Austria increased by 7.2%. Professor Bouquet writes, "By 1941, wartime mobilization was bringing palpable improvement in the material conditions of everyday life to many Austrians," unquote. In November of 1941, Austria's bishops issued a pastoral letter, which was read in all churches, that reiterated support for the war against Soviet Russia. In it, the Catholic leaders solemnly declared that Germany was conducting a crusade against a monstrous threat to Western civilization. Rather than keep silent, the bishops went on, Catholics should recognize the danger for all Europe should Bolshevism prevail. During the war years, Austrians continued to apply in large numbers to join the National Socialist Party, so that by May 1943, 2/3 of a million Austrians had signed up. In short, Austrian support for Hitler and National Socialist Germany remained strong to the end. Well, for listeners who are interested in more about all this, I recommend again the DVD that was mentioned earlier, Hitler's Place in History, which is available from the IHR. I'm going to talk now about a view of America and our place in the world that is very widespread among many Americans who call themselves conservatives. The other week I received a fundraising letter from a group called the Constitutional Coalition. It's based in St. Louis, Missouri, and it publishes a news sheet called Frontline. Now, I don't have any particular grievance or dissatisfaction with this group. I'm going to talk about this letter from the Constitutional Coalition, not because it's all that special, but precisely because it's typical. It's pretty representative of how many American conservatives see the situation in this country today. It also typifies the confusion and the narrow perspective of many Americans who call themselves conservatives, but are very outraged about what's happening to the country they love and confused about how it got to this situation, how it got to this point, and what to do about it. Now, in this letter, it's signed by Donna Hearn, who apparently is the director or the manager for the Constitutional Coalition. In this letter, Donna Hearn writes, "Dear friend of freedom," she writes that right now there is an epic struggle to determine who will write your future and control America. There are three contenders and a choice. Option one, a constitutional America where you make the decisions about what kind of life you want to lead, where you want to live, and how you will teach your children about Christendom and the Constitution, freedom, and faith. Option two, a fascist, progressive, socialist America where all decisions are made by an all-knowing, all-seeing big brother who does not think you can be trusted to make decisions. The plan is for an elite of the powerful and wise to make the decisions that control America's wealth. Option three, an American Islamic caliphate where Sharia law determines every move you make, every decision, economic and personal. A world where there is no respect of human dignity, little hope, and historically, a world of war and brutality. Three futures for America. One future leads to freedom, the other two to slavery. She goes on to say that, incredibly, we can still make that choice. Now, first of all, this is a common scenario or a common way that many people who call themselves conservatives view the situation in America. They talk about a constitutional America as a kind of ideal, and they take the view that America has been getting away from a constitutional country toward one in which there is less and less freedom. And supposedly in the past, America was a country characterized by much more freedom than today. At the same time, these people claim that the reason America has gone off the wrong track and is going in the direction it is because it's veered away from a so-called constitutional America and is heading toward this fascist, progressive, socialist America, as Donna Hearn writes in this letter. In fact, that's the same kind of basic scenario that you'll hear every morning if you listen to the Rush Limbaugh show. And of course, there are many others, many Republican leaders like Sarah Palin, who put the question in much the same way. But it's really a false perspective. It's a false choice between different paths for America. Now, when people talk about a constitutional America, when supposedly there was more freedom in the past and less freedom today, they have a very strange view of American history. After all, up until the middle part of the 19th century, slavery was legal in the United States. I mean, very few people think that America, when it was closer to its original constitutional founding, was more free for those people who were slaves. And up until the beginning of the 20th century, more than half the population, that is women in America, had effectively no political role in American life at all. But even when you go back to say, let's take an example, 1927, just to pick a year, and say, well, were Americans more free or less free than they are today? Well, in 1927, you couldn't open a hardware store on a Sunday afternoon in most of America. In most of the country, laws prohibited stores and businesses from being open on Sunday afternoon out of respect for the Christian traditions in America. Now, maybe that's better, maybe it's worse, but the point is, today, that's one area where Americans are more free today than they were in 1927. Another example, in 1927, in any restaurant, you couldn't order a glass of wine or a beer, because in 1927, consumption of alcoholic beverages was illegal all across the United States of America. Today, of course, people can buy wine or alcohol in stores just about everywhere, and they can order it in bars and restaurants. In 1927, except perhaps in the state of Nevada, gambling was illegal in the United States. Now it's widespread in many parts of the country. There are state lotteries that didn't used to exist and so forth. Now, I'm not trying to say that in every way America is a freer country than it was in 1927. But it's important to remember that in many ways American life was more restrictive in 1927 or 1950 or 1960 than it is today. Or take the year 1960. In 1960, a large part of the American population who are non-white were effectively restricted or excluded from political life. In the states of the South, blacks effectively had no political voice whatsoever. Also in 1960, for Americans it was illegal to own gold coins or gold bullion. From 1933 up until the Nixon years, owning gold was illegal in the United States of America. Today it's legal. Now, again, it's not a black and white thing, but it's important to remember that, at least in some important respects, Americans are more free, quote-unquote, today than they were in 1960 or 1927 or 1900 or 1860. So that the choice between a so-called constitutional America and a progressive America in that regard is a misleading one. More than that, there are many people who believe that a constitutional America, the closer you get to the Constitution, the more representative that such a country is of the people. Well, in fact, the men who wrote the Constitution in Philadelphia did so in a secret meeting in which they didn't want any political parties, in which they also laid out a basic law for the country that severely restricted the extent to which the common people had any say whatsoever in national life. I'm going to take a break now. Please stick with us, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the outlook and the perspective on the trends in America today, as reflected in a recent fundraising letter by a group called the Constitutional Coalition, which laid out what it says are three choices for America. A choice or a path between a constitutional America on the one hand and a fascist progressive socialist America on the other hand. It also mentions the possibility or the option of America becoming an Islamic caliphate. But as I was starting to lay out, this is a very narrow perspective on American history and also a misleading one. I was talking about how a constitutional America is not necessarily, certainly based on American history, one in which there's more freedom for the American people. And there are many examples that one can point to and cite to show that, in at least in some important regards, Americans are individually more free today in many respects than they were 20, 40, 50, or 100 years ago. But more than that, the entire perspective on America as a so-called constitutional country suggests that the original Constitution was one that reflected a democratic America. Well, in fact, the original Constitution was written in such a way that the 55 men who put together the Constitution wanted to make sure that power was held in the hands of men like themselves. And they made sure there were extensive restrictions, in fact, on popular rule. Now, I won't go into all that here, but the claim that the alternative for America is a so-called fascist or progressive or socialist America is a false one. Very often when I talk with people who have this kind of outlook, I will say to them, I'll ask them this question. I'll say, leaving aside the United States of America, when you look around the world or consider the world we live in, tell me what country has a social political system, a way of life that comes closest to your ideal of how a country should be organized. Well, I find that many people who call themselves traditional conservatives have never really thought of it quite in those terms. In fact, just the other week I was having a conversation with someone who's a writer for a well-known libertarian think tank and has written a lot of articles and reviews for this libertarian organization. And I put this question to him. Leaving aside the United States of America, what country is closest to your ideal of how a society should be organized or a country to live in? Well, he said to me, I'd never thought of that, he said. Well, that's understandable, because many of those people who talk about the contrast between a so-called constitutional America and a, quote, socialist or fascist America look at things in a very particularly America-centric point of view, which is a very narrow point of view. To be more specific, given a choice between living in, say, Mexico on the one hand and Canada on the other, most American conservatives would prefer to live in Canada rather than Mexico, I think. And the reason is because life in Canada is a lot more like that in the United States, at least in, well, way of life and so forth, and crime rates and so forth. In fact, it's even better than the United States in many ways in those regards than Mexico. But if one looks at it from the point of view of the Constitutional Coalition, life in Mexico should be better than the United States of America. And here's why. Canada does not have a tradition of constitutional government as strong as that of Mexico. Canada didn't even have a written constitution until 1982. The Mexican Constitution, which is currently in force, was brought into effect in 1917, and in many regards is a copy of the United States Constitution. Mexico fought for independence against Spain, became an independent country. Canada never fought for independence. It stayed part of the British Empire. The head of state is still formally in Canada, the British Queen, the British monarch, Queen Elizabeth. Great Britain, which has a lower crime rate and is more prosperous than Mexico, for example, has no written constitution whatsoever. And if one tries to apply the template or the outlook of a group like the Constitutional Convention, Britain ought to be a terrible place and Mexico ought to be a wonderful place. Now, I'm exaggerating slightly to make a point. Haiti, to take an even more extreme example, has a constitution in place that is a copy or is based upon the American Constitution and the French Constitution. And the government plays very little role in the lives of its people. In Haiti, taxes are very low. Most people pay no taxes whatsoever. And the government plays almost no role in the lives of its people. It doesn't even collect the garbage. If your house is burning down, it's very likely that the fire department won't even come to put it out. But and Haiti has no national health care plan or health care system, for example. But it has a constitution in place that is in many ways a copy of the American Constitution. Haiti can hardly be called a fascist or progressive or socialist society. But Haiti is also a crime-ridden, corrupt, backward country, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. But my point here isn't that Haiti is therefore a desirable place to live in because it doesn't have a strong central government or a national health care plan. My point is simply that the basic law, the constitution of a country, is far less important than the culture, the mores, the behavior, the patterns of life of a people in a society. That's why, as I mentioned earlier, life in Britain for most Americans would be more agreeable than it is in, say, Mexico, even though Britain doesn't even have a written constitution. Because the constitution plays much less of a role in the life of a society than many conservative Americans like to believe. In fact, those people who talk about a constitutional America are hard put to define exactly what the limits of that kind of constitutional society should be. If you ask them, well, should we have a strict interpretation of the Constitution? That is, the federal government shouldn't be involved in any aspects of life or society that are not explicitly laid out by the Constitution. That would mean, for example, that we would have no interstate highway system. We would have no national park system. Now, maybe it would be desirable to have the parks run by private businesses or by the states. But the point is that it's hard to see how America would be necessarily a better place if the parks were run by the states or by private businesses rather than the federal government. The point also is that the Constitution, or what Americans mean by a constitutional government, has changed radically since the Constitution was first put into place in the end of the 18th century, and that very, very few of those people who talk about a constitutional America would really like to return to a society when the federal government or the American life was as limited or as organized as it was in the 19th or late 18th century of this country. Moreover, when looking around the world at countries or societies that are most agreeable or where life is closest to what most Americans would prefer, by all indexes, the countries in which life is more prosperous and so forth are countries that have what, from the point of view of the Constitutional Coalition, would be considered a so-called progressive or fascist state. Denmark, Italy, Germany, Sweden, Britain, Canada all have, for example, national health care systems. Now, I'm not saying that a national health care system is necessarily desirable, only that a national health care system in itself does not make a society a bad place or the government bad. And by the same token, a society that doesn't have a national health care plan or a society in which the government does not, when the government does not play a larger role and hands off, is necessarily a more desirable place. In fact, the societies that have a very limited government role in life include some of the very poorest countries in the world. Moreover, no matter how good or how bad a constitution is, or what the constitutional order of a society, that is no guarantee whatsoever that the society is not going to be corrupt, that it's not going to be crime-ridden, or that it will be poor. In fact, the assumption that a constitutional America is necessarily a prosperous America is not at all true. There's no reason whatsoever to think that because a society has a limited government, it's necessarily a more prosperous society. But this kind of thinking is typical of the America-centric, the narrow perspective. Now, this letter from the Constitutional Coalition goes on to say this. Think back. 1775, Trenton, New Jersey. 2,500 starved, tattered men had faith and hope and prevailed against the mightiest army in the world, ultimately winning in 1783. By 1789, 13 contentious colonies had produced the Constitution. Fast forward to 1939, when Hitler and Tojo attempted to control the world, but Americans made a choice. And by 1945, America was victorious. Each decision, each choice, was made by Americans of strong moral character. Well, this is an extraordinarily misleading characterization of history. Not so much talking about 1775 or 1783. I'm talking about the characterization here of 1939, World War II, and America during that conflict. She says, fast forward to 1939 when Hitler and Tojo attempted to control the world. Well, in fact, in 1939, at no time was Hitler interested in trying to control the world. In 1939, in September, Germany attacked Poland. It did so for reasons that had to do with the specific problems and grievances of Poland and the German dispute over certain areas, Danzig and the corridor and so forth. But it was Britain that declared war on Germany, not the other way around. And in 1939, the British Empire was at its height. No country in world history has controlled more people against their will than Great Britain did in 1939. But far from wanting to control the world, Hitler wanted to avoid war with Britain, with France, and certainly with the United States. Not only that, to say that Americans made a choice in 1939 is pretty extraordinary, because from the outbreak of war in September 1939 up until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, America was officially neutral. In fact, the choice officially that the United States made in 1939 was not to deal with Hitler or Tojo, it was to stay neutral. In 1941, Germany attacked the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet Union was formally and massively involved in war against Germany in June of 1941, before America was formally involved, and at a time when the United States formally was a neutral country. So just because somebody's at war with Hitler or Tojo, if that means that such a country is represents strong moral character, well, on that basis, then, the Soviet Union would be a country of strong moral character because it was involved in 1941 in war with Germany at a time when the United States of America was at least formally neutral. Also, it says Americans made a choice. Well, for those people who are defenders and upholders of America's traditional views on foreign policy and constitutional America, in 1940 and 41, such people were in favor of American neutrality. In 1940 and 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt was doing everything in his power to incite and encourage the American people to go to war against Germany. And the leaders of the America First Committee, which was opposed to war, and those people who upheld the traditional neutral foreign policy of the United States and the America First Committee, were opposed to Franklin Roosevelt and his efforts to try to get America into war. So in fact, the people who upheld America's traditional outlook on foreign policy, who were faithful to the foreign policy of George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and so forth, were not in favor of making a so-called moral choice to go to war against Hitler. They were in favor of staying out of the war in Europe at that time and to stay out of supporting Britain and the Soviet Union in 1941 against Germany. Then it says, by 1945, America was victorious. Well, that's true as far as it goes. But the country that was the most important military factor in defeating Germany in 1945 was not the United States of America, it was the Soviet Union. Three-fifths of Germans who were killed in World War II were killed on the Eastern Front by the Red Army, by the Soviet Union. It was the Soviet Union that was the most formidable military force that Germany faced in World War II, not the United States of America. American troops did not land on D-Day at Normandy in June 1944 until that landing, which was less than a year before the end of the war in Europe. But by June 1944, the D-Day landing, the tide of war had already dramatically and irretrievably shifted against Germany and in favor of the Soviet Union by the time American troops landed in the D-Day invasion of June 1944. Moreover, this letter goes on to say, each decision, each choice was made by Americans of strong moral character. Well, if she means by Americans of strong moral character, the President of the United States at the time in World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, that's pretty astonishing from any person who calls himself or herself a conservative. Franklin Roosevelt was despised and scorned by those Americans who call themselves conservatives. He was popular with many people, but he was also hated by many Americans. No American president did as much as quickly to enormously expand the power and authority of the federal government as Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt also carried out many policies that were indisputably violations of law and violations of the U.S. Constitution. But this simplistic representation of 20th century history, of America's role in World War II, is typical and representative of the outlook of many people who call themselves conservatives and upholders of the Constitution. In fact, it's as mentioned earlier, few presidents were more blatant in their scorn and disregard for the U.S. Constitution than President Franklin Roosevelt. So the letter goes on. Will you choose to help us return to America, to a nation where each individual, not an unelected bureaucratic, well, it's a typo, decides what kind of light bulb to use, what to eat, or the weather to host a neighborhood Bible study? Well, again, that's very simplistic. Yeah, if we return to the constitutional America that many of these people say they have in mind, it would be a country in which there would be no Pure Food and Drug Act, for example. And there was a time in America when there were no federal regulations on the quality and control of medicines. And people could put almost anything in a bottle and say that it's a medicine or a tonic. And there were no laws restricting that. Well, most Americans have come to believe that it's good to have laws in place and federal laws in place that require certain standards when people sell something that's called a medicine and something that's marketed in that way. But strictly speaking, yeah, if you go back to the constitutional America of, say, 1850, then we wouldn't have any such laws in place. Again, when we look around the world, most Americans believe, I think rightly, that it's good to have laws in place that protect Americans from people selling products that are harmful and misrepresented. outlook of this kind of simplistic outlook of many groups and many people who call themselves conservative is true not just of this group called this Constitutional Coalition, but also of many people that are running for president. I'm thinking particularly of Sarah Palin and people like that, Rush Limbaugh and so forth, who praise Ronald Reagan. Well, when Ronald Reagan ran for president, he promised to abolish the Department of Education and to reduce the size of the federal government. But it was Ronald Reagan who, in fact, not only did not get rid of the Department of Education, but in fact expanded the federal government during his tenure in office and began the an enormous increase in the national debt, a problem that has become now one that every American is aware of today. More than that, Sarah Palin and other people who are admirers of Ronald Reagan forget that it was his administration that carried out the illegal sale of weapons to Iran and the Islamic Republic of Iran in order to fund yet another illegal military intervention in Nicaragua. But many of these people who are admirers of Ronald Reagan prefer to forget all of that, because for many people, what's important and what they admire about Reagan is not what he actually did, it's his rhetoric. And that's, I suppose, part of the real problem, is that for many people, it's not what the actual policies are, it's how people feel about them, how well they're packaged. And that confusion between the appearance and the reality is part of a larger problem, I think, in our society. In a speech in Anaheim, California, in October of last year, Sarah Palin said in her talk to a large crowd that got a great deal of support that she said, "There's nothing wrong in America that a good old-fashioned election can't fix." Well, this statement is either simply pandering to what people want to hear, or, and she knows better, or it shows tremendous ignorance. The problems that America faces today are much more entrenched, much more deeply rooted than can be solved by in a good old-fashioned election, as she says. And nowhere is that more true than here in California. California has changed drastically, and I think for the worse, over the last 50 years. And the changes are social, cultural, and demographic, changes that, as she puts it, a good old-fashioned election simply cannot fix. And that's why looking at what's going on in America today and looking at these kinds of questions, it's important to have a perspective on the past that includes not just a wishful thinking look at American history, but understands the larger historical context. Because what America is going through today is in many ways parallels the fate of other countries that have overreached themselves with a myopic and imperial ambition that's coming up against a very hard reality. Well, that's it for this broadcast. I hope you'll join me for the next broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.